Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we interview philosophers about their new books in a wide variety of areas, including ethics, metaphysics, epistemology, social and political philosophy, philosophy of mind, philosophy of science, and many more. Today's interview is with Muhammad Ali Khalidi, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Cognitive Science Program at York University. We're talking about his new book, Natural Categories and Human Kinds, which is just out from Cambridge University Press. The division between natural kinds, the kinds that cut nature at its joints, and those that simply reflect human interests and values, has a long history. The natural kinds are often thought to have certain essential characteristics that are fixed by nature, such as a particular atomic number, while other kinds, of which a commonly cited example is race, are contentious precisely because they appear to group things, in this case people, by features that reflect social mores and not real essences. That natural versus socially constructed difference, of course, depends on what an essence is, as well as whether having an essence is the mark of a natural kind. In his new book, Khalidi argues for what he calls an epistemic view of natural kinds, in which they are the kinds that correspond to our best scientific categories and satisfy various epistemic virtues. On his view, natural kinds do not have essences, often have fuzzy boundaries, can satisfy the relevant epistemic virtues to differing degrees, and can be mind-dependent in a way that does not impugn their objectivity. The result is a challenging view of natural kinds that avoids problems associated with essentialist views, but also widens the scope of what may be a natural kind to include potentially many of those often considered to be socially constructed. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Professor Khalidi.
Hi. Thanks very much for having me on your podcast.
Yeah, I'm very excited to hear about your new book, Natural Categories and Human Kinds. I wanted to start with the basic background question of, you know, how you came to write this book about natural kinds, why you got interested in this topic, and perhaps, you know, its place, its role in your larger philosophical project and philosophical interests.
Yeah, well, I guess like many philosophers, I came to philosophy from science. I started out by studying physics at university, but I think I always had certain philosophical interests even then. And in fact, even before going to university, I'd been exposed to a little bit of philosophy, and I was interested in logic. And so I've always been interested in foundational questions in science, categorization, classification systems, what makes them valid, what makes them legitimate. And eventually, when I went to graduate school and studied philosophy, I also focused on these foundational questions in science. I wrote my dissertation on incommensurability and worked a little bit on reductionism. And I've been thinking about categories and classification off and on really since then. And I've written a few papers over the years about what philosophers call natural kinds, which is roughly what they mean by that, I think, is what are the categories that are valid or that truly correspond to divisions in nature. So the natural kinds are supposed to be those divisions in nature that really exist. And I was always interested in getting to the bottom of that debate in trying to resolve this question. And so eventually I thought that I would try to tackle it in book length form, not just in a series of articles. So that's how I came to write the book.
So you clearly have been thinking, I mean, it comes through very clearly that you've been thinking about these things from a variety of angles. So for a long time, and you begin the book by setting the stage with, you know, sort of the basic metaphysical questions, right? What is a kind, right? How is it related to properties? So maybe just to set our stage as well, you could say, you know, what is a kind on your view, and what motivates us to posit kinds to begin with?
Yeah, I guess one could distinguish two questions. I don't know if people have very clearly always distinguished those two questions, but there's what you might call the what question and the which question. So the what question is, what are kinds, metaphysically speaking? Are they, for instance, just collections of particulars? Are they sets, as, say, traditionally nominalists might have it? Or are they more like universals, as metaphysical realists would have it? And if they are universals, are they, you know, completely abstract entities? Are they transcendent universals like Platonic forms, or are they immanent? David Armstrong thinks of universals as being present in each of their instances. So there are those big questions, the what question, what is a kind, metaphysically speaking, what does it correspond to? And frankly, that's, I find, a very perplexing question that I don't have a crisp answer to. What I do in the book is to show some of the pros and cons of these various conceptions, and I think I sort of leave it as an open question. And I move on to consider this other question, which is what I refer to as the which question, which is, which kinds are there? So you could distinguish the metaphysical question about the status of kinds from perhaps an ontological question about which kinds should we admit into our ontology, whether they're abstract universals or whether they're just sets of particulars. Mm-hmm. Which of them are somehow correspond to things in reality? Which of these categories that we posit corresponds to divisions in nature? And so I focus most of the book on the which question. In other words, which of our categories are natural kinds?
So you, in the beginning, few chapters, you go through, you know, various alternatives before, you know, getting to and then defending and elaborating on your own epistemic view. I don't know if we need to go through all of the other alternatives, but maybe you can focus on one of them, perhaps some essentialist view, and what you find to be, you know, wrong or mistaken about those alternatives, and how that motivates your own alternative.
Yeah, I think essentialism has become the dominant view among philosophers as to what distinguishes the natural kinds from other, you know, artificial kinds or gerrymandered kinds, or what distinguishes categories that correspond to natural kinds from ones that don't. And the essentialists, I guess the way they go about it is by identifying certain criteria that they consider to be features that you would need to find in kinds. And they don't always agree on which exact criteria kinds satisfy. But I think there's a list of four or five things that most essentialists have identified as being features of natural kinds. And there are things like natural kinds need to be associated with a set of properties as necessary and sufficient conditions. And so each natural kind is associated with a set of properties that each of which is necessary for belonging to that kind, and they're jointly sufficient. Another feature is that these properties need to be intrinsic. They need to be modally necessary. They must hold across possible worlds, if you like. Some essentialists also add that they have to be microstructural and so on. But now this whole strategy, I think there's a couple things wrong with this strategy. I mean, first of all, I think there's a real question as to where these desiderata or where these desirable features are coming from. I mean, on what basis are we positing that natural kinds need to have these features? And I don't think that's been adequately justified by essentialists. Could it be just a result of certain cognitive biases that we have, or a desire to see a kind of neatness in the universe that we posit that they need to be associated with a set of properties by way of necessary and sufficient conditions? I don't think those kinds of features have been demonstrated to have been justified as desiderata that we posit. The other problem with this general strategy, it seems to me, apart from the whole justification of where these features come from, is that on closer inspection, I argue that most of the paradigmatic natural kinds actually fail to satisfy one or the other of these features. And so even the natural kinds that essentialists unanimously are committed to as being true natural kinds don't really have the features that they're posited to have, I think, on closer inspection. So I think that whole approach has misled us. I think that we need to take a different attitude towards identifying natural kinds.
So your view, I mean, if you, propose an alternative set of desiderata derived from science, basically a group of scientific virtues. So maybe you could say a bit about what your alternative consists of, and then how it relates to the usual desiderata of fixed boundaries or having certain modal status or being microphysical.
Right. Well, I think rather than say that I've sort of set out from a different set of desiderata, I guess what my approach is to say, well, how should we go about determining which divisions actually exist in nature? Well, we have no alternative to our best epistemic practices, right? We have ways of investigating the world. We have ways of discerning what sort of groupings there exist in the world. And those ways of investigation are roughly coextensive with the enterprise that we call science. And so science tries to group things into categories in order to explain and predict and understand the features of the world, the causal structure of the world. And it seems to me we have no alternative but to rely on our best epistemic practices for coming up with valid categories or good classification schemes. And those valid categories or good classification schemes are none other than the categories that correspond to natural kinds. So there's a sense in which, yeah, I'm going from epistemology to metaphysics, but I don't think there's really any alternatives to that, unless we sort of posit that we've got some kind of a priori means of determining what the features of the universe are. And I'm not prepared to accept an assumption like that.
So let me just focus on one or two of the the epistemic virtues, like projectability of a particular category or predicate. And then the idea also that natural kinds, that there's a sense in which they're revisable, right? Mm-hmm. Both of these things sort of, you know, are very much against the grain of the, you might say, the natural kind tradition, if you want to put it that way. One of the things that you say is that projectability will come in degrees, right? And you may be completely correct that, you know, nature, you know, doesn't obey these strict boundaries that you know, other philosophers have associated with natural kinds. And so then the question will sort of arise, well, if you have a kind that is not highly projectable or satisfies the other epistemic criteria to a degree, mm-hmm. Then or just has vague boundaries or something like that, then are we really talking about natural kinds or sort of are different kinds kind of natural kinds or kind of joint like or something like that? I mean, once you introduce the idea of a degree, right, then what happens to the concept of it being natural, you know, corresponding to a joint?
Yeah. Well, I think there've been some philosophers who are impatient with the essentialist approach and think that it doesn't apply to lots of categories. And then they say, well, but then there are these other things which we might call epistemic kinds or investigative kinds. And as though that was kind of second best. But it seems to me there are very few categories, if any, in nature that satisfy the desiderata that essentialists have come up with. And it's not as though there are these sort of second best categories and that they fail to measure up to some of the essentialist criteria. Let me maybe give a concrete example to make this a little bit more vivid.
Sure.
So let's take the categories that almost everyone agrees are correspond to natural kinds and are very crisp, nice, sharp, bounded mm-hmm. Kinds, say the elements of the periodic table.
Right.
And let's take an element like lithium, atomic number 3. Now, this is seems like the paradigm case of a natural kind. So lithium has atomic number 3, and from this flow all these other properties, such as that lithium is a metal and that it has a certain kind of electrical conductivity and a density and reactivity with water, let's say it's flammable. And then it has all sorts of other properties when ionized. For instance, it has a certain kind of psychopharmacological properties. It has an effect on the brain and stabilizing mood disorders and all that. But now it seems as though the necessary and sufficient criterion for being an atom of lithium is to have atomic number 3. But it turns out that some isotopes of lithium are more stable than others. And so the isotopes with mass numbers 6 and 7 are more stable, and they're the ones that actually have most of these properties. And as you get to less stable isotopes, then they have less and less of these properties because they're not around long enough. They decay by radioactive decay too quickly to have many of these properties. And so we're finding that the boundaries that we want to draw around this particular chemical element are themselves kind of fuzzy, and they shade off a little bit. Do we want to consider lithium 8 to be a member of this kind just as much as lithium 6 or lithium 7, which are the stable isotopes? Well, for some purposes, yes, and for some purposes, no. So it turns out that nature actually has fuzzier boundaries than I think many philosophers have imagined or posited. And so I think that when we find that the universe doesn't correspond to our preconceptions in this way, it behoves us to change some of these preconceptions and to say, well, yes, it turns out that there are joints in nature, but perhaps they're a little fuzzier, they're a little less crisp than we might have wanted to imagine. And so it seems to me that this is the case across the board. So it's not just that, well, some of the categories in the special sciences or in the biological or social sciences are fuzzy or are not sharp throughout. It turns out that this actually pertains to some of the most basic kinds in nature that everyone agrees are natural kinds.
So I suppose the question that sort of kept coming to me as I read the book was what you described before. You're starting with sort of epistemology, this the science, and you're making an inference, you might say, about the metaphysics or to the metaphysics. And I kept thinking about the sort of background realist commitment that seemed to be behind the whole book in general. So what is it that if even our paradigmatic kinds don't really correspond to what we preconceptually think of as, these sharp joints. But everything's kind of fuzzy to different degrees. What is it that naturalness buys us?
Well, I mean, I think that one reason that philosophers are should be concerned with this topic is that it's a concern for many working scientists and for us as citizens generally. I mean, these questions come up in science all the time. Which categories are valid? On what basis should we posit categories? Scientists in different fields talk about things like construct validity, or how should we operationalize this category? And then these questions also come up in public discourse. Are some of these social categories valid or not? Should we be classifying people into this system of taxonomic categories or this other system, which are just prejudices of ours and which correspond to real divisions in the world? And so we as philosophers, I think, who try to think about these things in a more abstract way and try to have a kind of big picture account, take a step back from the details, the messy details of each of these sciences in each of these domains, I think it's incumbent on us to try and draw some general lessons or to come up with some general recommendations as to the basis upon which we should make these kinds of determinations. And I guess I think of myself as being engaged in a small way in this whole effort. So that's, I think, what it buys us. I think that we have a genuine need to distinguish categories which are really, correspond to divisions in the natural and social world, and categories which are just a result of perhaps certain biases that we might have had or are posited as a result of certain misleading ideas about what exists in the world and so on.
So let me ask about the revisability issue, which I raised a bit before.
Yeah.
Sort of feeds into the same sort of issue about what we get from calling something natural, if indeed such natural categories are revisable, as they, on your account, they ought to be. So can you say a word about how the issue of the revisability of natural kinds?
Yeah, let me make a distinction. At one point in the book, I talk about the revisability of our categories, and then mm-hmm. later on, I also talk about the mutability of kinds themselves.
Okay.
So, we often will revise our early on in the book as an attempt to show that our epistemic practices really do try to track divisions of in nature. I talk about revisability as one indication. I mean, it's not a surefire demonstration, but it's one indication that what we're trying to do is to refine, adapt, and otherwise change the boundaries of our categories so as to better conform to the causal structure of the world. And we see this happening all the time in science as we revise certain categories, we shape them and mold them in a certain way in order to better capture the causal structure of the world. And so I see that as being a big part of the scientific enterprise and as an indication that what science is trying to do is to try to capture the causal structure of the world. But then there's another issue which crops up with some categories in various domains, which is that the kinds themselves sometimes are mutable. Let's call it the mutability of kinds, as opposed to the revisability of our categories. And, this is, perhaps most prominently illustrated by, say, the case of biological species, which do evolve and change over time and so on. And it also happens in the social world quite a bit. And Ian Hacking, for instance, has talked about the looping effect of human kinds or the interactivity. And what he means by that is the way in which they change, the categories themselves, the kinds themselves, their properties change in response to sometimes human attitudes and so on. And I think that is an issue that does crop up more prominently in the biological and social realms. I mean, I should emphasize that it's not just the social realm, it's the biological realm. But I suspect that it's not impossible for it to happen in the physical or chemical realms. Some physicists now speculate that perhaps the properties of elementary particles have not stayed uniform throughout the history of the universe and might have been quite different. The masses of elementary particles might have been different early on in the history of the universe. Now, of course, you might say, but that's, cosmic time. That's cosmological time. That's not, in the lifetime of human beings. But, there are differences of degree, but I'm not sure that should matter to us in principle. I think as philosophers, what we're interested in are these broad features and determining whether these features pertain, purely to the social realm or to the biological or to other realms. And so I think there's good reason to think that this might be a feature of kinds across the board, this kind of mutability. Now, if kinds are mutable in this way, does that mean that they're not natural or they're not real? And I'm not sure that we should say that. I mean, if nature itself turns out to be mutable, if nature itself turns out to change, well, that's just a feature of the universe that we've discovered. Our disposition to think of nature as being fixed or immutable has just turned out to be misleading, misguided.
Okay, that's a good distinctions there. Let me go back. You mentioned two things that I want to get back to. One, the causal structure issue, and then what you called the looping effect, which there's a broader questions there. But you distinguish your view from the one associated with Richard Boyd of homeostatic property clusters. Right, that sort of causal structure as the basis of a natural kind, and you align yourself with Carl Craver's simple causal theory. So maybe you can say a word about this causal structure that we're supposed to be capturing with our natural, with our categories, and how you sort of distinguish your view from Boyd's view, and then, you know, align it with Craver's view.
Yeah, I mean, I think Richard Boyd really moved the debate forward a great deal, and moved us, I think, away from essentialism, although some people have tried to interpret his theory in essentialist terms. But Boyd said that a lot of kinds have this structure whereby there's some kind of mechanism that keeps a cluster of properties in homeostasis. So the reason that we have kinds in nature, the reason that we have sets of properties that always reoccur and that cluster together in this way, is because there are sometimes mechanisms in nature whereby these clusters of properties, loose clusters perhaps, not strict clusters sometimes, are kept together in a state of equilibrium or homeostasis. And I think when he proposed this, I don't think he was suggesting that this applied to all kinds, or that all kinds had these features. And I think he was mainly thinking of biological kinds as having these features. And I think he's right that many biological kinds do have this kind of structure, where you've got some kind of mechanism that generates these properties and keeps them more or less in equilibrium. But it seems to me that there are lots of kinds that don't have quite that structure. For a start, there's not always a mechanism, really, that's keeping the properties together. Sometimes one or a few properties are instantiated together or co-instantiated, and then they lead reliably to a set of other properties. This doesn't really happen as a result of a mechanism or anything like that. I don't think it's a perfectly general account. And in a way, I think that what I'm trying to do is relax these conditions a little bit and say that when we don't require there to be a mechanism, or don't always say that there's a kind of tendency towards equilibrium, then what we end up with is what Karl Craver, as you say, calls a simple causal theory. And I don't know, I mean, I think I don't think Craver talks about this in in more than just one or two articles, and I'm not sure that he's tried to develop this in any detail, but I think it's several other philosophers have been thinking along these lines and have been saying, well, Boyd's account is great and it works very well in say the biological domain. Although maybe I should add parenthetically here that some people have also criticized Boyd's account as not applying very well to the biological domain either. Mm-hmm. But some people have said, well, it applies nicely to the biological domain, but, you know, maybe we could relax some of these conditions a little bit. And I think that when we do, what we end up with is an attempt to track these general causal structures. And what I find when I look at a number of case studies is that there are these causal processes that kinds feature in. And there's a slogan that I use, and I'm not sure how useful it is, but I talk about nodes in causal networks. So there are these causal networks, and the kinds represent certain central nodes in these causal networks, where certain properties come together on a regular basis, and then they generate certain other properties in these recurring patterns or networks.
So much of the debate about natural kinds, there's a lot of different debates there. I mean, obviously within the biological realm, some people want to say those kinds, you know, are natural. Some, like Brian Ellis, will say, nope, the biological kinds are not. But a lot of the discussion of natural kinds that gets more harder to resolve, I should maybe, are more involved with the special sciences, which would include biology, but of course, obviously, the social sciences and psychology and the human sciences. And there you have, you know, this idea that here we've got sciences, if they count as sciences even, where the kinds are socially constructed, or they're just dependent on us, or in some sense they have some feature that prevents them from being natural kinds, right? So it's not just the fuzziness maybe of different isotopes of lithium, but it's just that these, you know, very high-order human sorts of social categories are just completely out of the ballpark. And on your view, that's just not true. And so you discuss various of these features that are supposed to attach to categories in the social sciences or the human sciences, which are supposed to rule them out as, you know, can't possibly be natural kinds. And some of these are like they're conventional in some way or institutional, or they're just copied kinds, or they're merely disjunctive, and so forth. So maybe, it would be, important to talk about, you know, how you address each of these, you know, supposedly, you know, very problematic features of categories in social human sciences that, on your view, you know, don't create a problem for considering those categories as corresponding to natural kinds.
Yeah. I mean, one sort of general point that I want to emphasize is what I tried to do is to look at a range of kinds from the most basic physical chemical up into the psychiatric. And in doing so, what I found is that there are no real sharp divides, in the sense that it's not that we find these the characteristics of the kinds at the physical or chemical level that we don't find at all at these other levels or in these other domains. And I find that there's a kind of continuity and the assumptions that we've made that there are somehow essence kinds in say the physical or chemical domain, but then not in the biological or social domains. I think that's not the case. And one property and kind that I use kind of throughout the book to illustrate some of these points is the property of viscosity and the kind Newtonian fluid, which occurs in fluid dynamics. And part of the reason that I do that is that it's a nice example of a kind from the physical sciences that is functional and is it only really pertains to the macro level and has some of these features that we tend to associate with the non-physical kinds and properties. But having said that, it is true that some features tend to pertain more or tend to be more often found in, say, the biological and social realms than in these other realms. So maybe etiological kinds identified on the basis of their causal history as opposed to their causal powers, tend to be more prominent in the biological and social domains. Although, you know, I do mention instances of this occurring in sciences such as astronomy or geology and so on. So, for instance, we identified types of rocks as igneous or metamorphic or sedimentary based on their causal history, not so much their actual synchronic causal properties. And I do think, I mean, there are a couple of features which I do think are pose a problem for considering certain categories to correspond to natural kinds. I think etiology really does represent a bit of an exception, because what we're doing there is we're individuating things, or we're grouping them together, as I said, on the basis of their causal history, as opposed to their causal powers. And even though that's still an attempt to discern the causal structure of the world, it's really looking at sort of the end point of a causal process rather than the beginning point. And so those kinds are special in a certain way, whether they're biological or social, or whether they pertain to astronomy or geology or something like that. But now, as to other features, one thing that you mentioned where I would, I do think that the feature really does make it that a kind is not properly speaking a natural kind, and that is if a kind is purely conventionally based. So kinds that whose properties are linked together as a result of human convention, or because of our legal systems, or because of our moral beliefs. I think those are not causal and therefore don't really pertain to the causal structure of the world. So let me give you an example. Take a social category like a permanent resident of a certain country, right? And now suppose we pass a law that permanent residents must not have a criminal record, or permanent residents must be literate or something like that. Now, those properties then become associated as a result of human convention, not as a result of the causal structure of the world. And so if I find that, oh, lo and behold, all permanent residents are literate, can read and write, well, that's not really a discovery about the world, right? That's because we've written it into the law that all permanent residents should know how to read and write. So you'd never give a sociologist a grant to go and study that, right? if they came up with that finding, that would not be real news. But now it gets a bit complicated sometimes, because once we've specified those kinds, they can come to have a causal role, or they can come to play a causal role in this, you know, sociological structure, or in the, I should say, the social in the social structure. So suppose that now permanent residents, it turns out, all gravitate towards large urban centers. And so it turns out that permanent residents are all or predominantly urban dwellers. Now that's, I think, a real causal connection between the property or the kind of permanent resident and being an urban dweller. And so I think sometimes it gets complicated, because conventional kinds then go on to have a kind of causal dimension, and it becomes complicated to separate out their causal and their conventional dimensions. But if they are purely conventional, it seems to me then there's no real reason to think of them as natural kinds, because they don't pertain to the causal structure of the world. And in this case, it's the social world that sociologists and social scientists study.
Well, let me then ask a question about, you know, this. Maybe this has been sort of behind the idea and the realism issue that was sort of in the back of my mind as I read the book. So you identify you call it various times natural kinds, sort of epistemic kinds, and you say that, you know, these are the categories, you know, from the sciences that are projectable, and they, you know, let us they support good inductive generalizations, they generate new predictions, they are fertile in terms of explanation and so forth, right? And these are all various you know, epistemic virtues associated with good and productive sciences. But then there's this causal structure. And I'm just wondering if what's sort of doing the work to get you from the epistemic categories to the kinds is that the kinds are really, is it the case that the natural kinds really are these that are, you know, that they, those kinds are determined by real causal structures, and the epistemic issue is really how we identify them, but that's not what the natural kinds are. Do you see my, so I'm sort of wondering to what extent your epistemic view is in fact, you know, really just, or I shouldn't say just, but I mean, just a causal structure view of some sort. Natural kinds are those that are, you know, nodes in causal networks. And this is how we find them out. And, you know, and that's the complete story.
Yeah. Well, I guess I go from epistemology to metaphysics. So it seems to me that what science is trying to discern is the causal structure of the world. And so whichever categories have these kinds of epistemic virtues that they figure in good explanations and are good for inductions and so on are the ones that are going to correspond to important features of the causal structure of the world. As you said, nodes in the causal networks. And I know that this is, there's a kind of trend in contemporary philosophy to say, don't mix your epistemology with your metaphysics. And if you're making any inferences from epistemology to metaphysics, then you're kind of verificationist, and this is a real philosophical faux pas. And I think that's a very misleading way of looking at things, because it seems to me the alternative to that is just doing metaphysics in a kind of a priori fashion and saying that, well, we have these strong intuitions about how the world has to be, and that's our best guide to the structure of the universe. And I just think that that approach is not tenable any longer. I'm not willing to accept that we've got some kind of intuitive knack for understanding what the universe is like. And instead, it seems to me that what we need to go on are our epistemic practices and what we can discover. And what we can discover about the world is its causal joints. And so it seems to me there's nothing illegitimate in going from our best epistemic practices to inferring something about the causal structure of the world. Now, I mean, I don't attempt a full-blown defense of scientific realism, and I think there are some good defenses out there that I've relied upon to a large extent. But it seems to me that that's really the direction of the inference that from our from these kinds of from categories that satisfy certain epistemic virtues to kinds that are part of the causal structure of the world.
Okay, fair enough. Let me ask then about you had mentioned before the looping effect, right? The interactive effect, and you went into it a little bit, but I just wanted to ask sort of directly about this issue of, you know, mind dependence, you know, which is often touted as one of the markers of a category that that can't be natural, right? And so, you know, in effect, this idea of being mind independent or mind dependent has been kind of a proxy in some contexts for a natural versus, you know, socially constructed or conventional kind distinction. And you don't think that mind dependence or independence for that matter is a worthwhile criterion for making the distinctions that you want to draw. So maybe you could just say something about, you know, sort of problematic kinds of mind dependence and then the non-problematic kinds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I mean, that this was a bit of a revelation, I think, for me while I was writing the book. I just came to the realization that this criterion of mind independence, which has become so common in any discussion of realism, and it's present in many philosophers' criteria of what is real, that the real ought to be mind independent, I just think is very misleading, because it's not as though the mind is not part of reality, and it's not as though that things that might be dependent on the mind in various ways are therefore not real. I mean, I think many philosophers are committed to the reality of minds and the reality of things that ensue from those minds. And so to insert that as a criterion, mind independence as a criterion for something being real, I think is really misses the point. It's a bit of a red herring. And I understand where it's coming from. And I think it's coming from this idea to say, well, what we want is to know what the universe would be like completely without our presence in it, or something like that. Mm. And I understand that impulse, but it's not that's what we want is, I mean, because we are part of the universe and we influence the universe in certain ways and we create real effects. And so I guess what we want is something more like the structure of the universe, including minds and their effects. And so I think that thinking of mind independence as being criterial for realism is really not the way to go. So something can be real while also being dependent in various ways on human minds. I mean, I mentioned one way in which a certain kind of mind dependence does undermine something's being real, and something's being purely a matter of convention or pertaining to certain legal distinctions that we make, or certain legal associations or moral associations, that those don't pertain to the causal structure of the world. And so there are types of mind dependence that are problematic, but I think that the that what we should be concerned with is trying to identify those types of mind dependence that undermine something's being, you know, part of the real causal structure of the world. I don't know if that helps or clarifies. Mind.
Yeah, and I guess it sort of leads to my next question, is probably the last question because we're running towards the end of our time, but the issue of normativity which you discuss, you know, a lot of the social categories do include at least some element of normativity. And this kind of gets back to what Hacking's looping, you know, interactive, you know, people are categories in certain ways and then they behave, you know, in ways that conform to the norm. And so there's this sort of back and forth between the categorization and the behavior. How do you deal with the issue of the normativity of kinds and, you know, how they do or don't satisfy your criteria for, you know, a category should serve the epistemic purposes of science. And that seems to rule out that, you know, any sort of category that has a normative component won't come out as being natural. But of course, then people will say, well, they all have a normative component, or many of them do. Mm-hmm. And this comes out, I think, probably most clearly in, you know, the more inflammatory contexts of categorization, like, you know, racial categories, right, or gender categories or things like that. So can you say a word about the issue of normativity?
Yeah, I mean, I think the clearest cases are where we try to change the boundaries of a category purely in response to certain evaluative judgments that we make. And Hacking has a very nice example of this, and he talks about the category of child abuse, which is an important category for sociologists and social psychologists understanding why people behave the way they behave and so on. But then an effort was made that Hacking describes to alter the boundaries of this category of child abuse to include, let's say, certain women who were drinking heavily or taking drugs while pregnant. And certain lobbying groups in the United States in particular started saying, well, we should treat this as a form of child abuse because they did not condone this behavior and they wanted to censure it and bring it under the umbrella of child abuse would have helped further that cause. Now, if this is done purely because people have certain kinds of evaluative attitudes and they try to change the boundaries of a category based on those evaluative attitudes, it seems to me that that kind of move can be uncovered and revealed not to correspond to the kinds of causes and effects that we're trying to track. And that very often is the case and does happen. And in fact, it did happen in this case because the sociologists and the social workers who are interested in understanding the causes of child abuse and the effects of child abuse started saying, well, no, this kind of thing that you're pointing to doesn't fit under the same umbrella. It doesn't have the same causes. It doesn't lead to the same effects. And therefore, to bring it under the category of child abuse is purely a kind of evaluative move on your part and is not done in the spirit of understanding how this category interacts or is integrated into the causal structure of society. And so those are the clearest cases where we try to alter the boundaries of a category purely in response to some kind of evaluative attitude that we take. And it seems to me that those attempts can be exposed quite easily. And I should mention here that it's not always certain kinds of problematic attitudes. I mean, there's sometimes when altering the boundaries of the category can be done in the spirit of actually trying to ameliorate things or improve conditions. I have an example that I discussed briefly where certain psychiatrists say that the category of mild cognitive impairment, MCI, has been very beneficial because it's led people to treat geriatrics with dementia and certain other kinds of disorders much more favorably, even though it groups together a disparate collection of disorders and does not really describe a valid category from the point of view of psychiatry. But it's had these beneficial effects. And it seems to me, again, one can detect that as being a kind of illegitimate move if one's really trying to understand certain kinds of psychiatric and social causes and effects. But now there are trickier cases where those kinds of evaluative moves themselves have causal repercussions and cause certain changes in the social world. And once that happens, it seems to me that the kind itself has changed. And then we, as investigators into the social world, or sometimes actually the natural world, have to take that into account in order to better understand the ways in which these kinds are interacting. If we're interested in understanding causes and effects, and so again, as with the sort of conventional case that I discussed earlier, where as a result of convention you introduce a certain kind, and then it comes to have certain repercussions, real causal effects. So too here, sometimes those kinds of evaluative moves then have causal repercussions and we have to sort of take them into account. But as long as they're purely done for purposes of moral censure or moral amelioration or something like that, it seems to me they're not going to correspond to real natural kinds.
So let me close with, so how would, on your view, I mean, let's take the category of race. Mm-hmm. How does your approach change, or how should we consider the category of race on, you know, given your, within your framework, where does that category fall?
Yeah. I mean, I hesitate always to pronounce on categories that I haven't tried to study in any detail, but a lot of philosophers have, and I think there's a lot of important and interesting work on this category, not all of which I've read, but I'm familiar with some of it. And I what I find most convincing is our treatments that say that race doesn't really correspond to any meaningful biological distinction. So any race categories that we tend to identify don't enter into any real biological causal processes. But it seems to me that race does play a role in explaining and understanding the social world, and it does have certain causal effects, and it does enter into important causal processes at the social or sociological level. And so it's not a biological category, but a sociological category, and therefore corresponds to some kind of social kind. It's a bit complicated because sometimes what can happen is that if you have a social kind, it might then go on to create or to have biological repercussions. And so I think Philip Kitcher has a treatment according to which he thinks that as a result of prejudice and as a result of certain biases against intermarriage, there have been these practices, these social practices that have led to biological differences. Now, I am skeptical that these biological differences are really robust enough to enter into biological causal processes, but I think it's possible, and it's an interesting example of a top-down effect where you might have certain social prejudices or barriers that themselves have biological repercussions. So it seems to me that one way to understand race is to understand it primarily as being a social category and as featuring in social causes and effects and not as a biological category. And I think part of the confusion when one says, oh, it's a real category and it corresponds to a natural kind, part of the confusion lies in some people drawing the assumption that, oh, well, then it must correspond to something at the biological level.
Right.
But I think it's quite possible for something to be a natural kind in the social domain without being a natural kind at the biological domain.
Okay, very good. Well, we're out of time. So I guess my last question is, where do you go from here? Do you have what are you working on now? Following up this book or just separate projects entirely?
Well, I have a couple of separate projects. I mean, I'm also interested in philosophy of cognitive science, and I've done some work on some categories in the cognitive sciences, like the category of innateness, mm-hmm. and concepts and domain specificity, all of which are categories that feature prominently in contemporary cognitive science, and I'm interested in understanding whether they're valid and whether they correspond to natural kinds. So I'm interested in sort of those micro projects, I guess. But I guess I would like to be able to explore more the issue of social kinds, and I think there's much more work to be done on understanding what social kinds are and you know, how they interact with, say, biological and other kinds. And I hope to be able to pursue that to some extent also in the future.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you very much for your time. And it's been great talking with you about your book.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, it's a real privilege to be able to discuss these matters. And I'm really grateful to you for having given the book such a close reading and thought up some really great questions. I hope my answers have done your questions justice.
Sure. No, it was a great read.
Excellent.
Okay, thank you. You've been listening to an interview with Muhammad Ali Khalidi, professor of philosophy at York University, about his new book, Natural Categories and Human Kinds, which is just out from Cambridge University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.